So, Revelation chapter 8 and 9 tonight. I was looking at our tentative schedule and realized that I crammed into 1 week what we had planned for 2 weeks. So, sorry if that messed up your reading plan, but we really didn't need 2 weeks to cover the seven seals. So, and it will give us time at the end of the semester to do some backward-thinking theological summary on the book of Revelation. So I think it'll work out well. We're going to cover chapters 8 and 9, which is the seven trumpets tonight. in the same pattern as the seven seals, we have a series of four at the beginning, and then we have a series of three at the end. And the three at the end are two with a big pause in between the second and third. An interlude. We talked about it last week. So tonight, we won't get into the interlude. The interlude is two whole chapters itself. It's more lengthy than the pause between seals number 6 and 7. The pause between trumpets number 6 and 7 is two whole chapters on its own. And so we'll save that for next week. Then, March 1st is Ash Wednesday. And so we will all collectively take a pause in our study for Ash Wednesday service on March 1st. And then we'll reconvene on March 8th and dive into the dragon and the beasts, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the next few weeks if you're reading along. By the way, some of you may have purchased the book that that we had offered. You can read really any book on Revelation. It'll give you, probably no book you read is going to give you the same perspective that I do. And so you could read Left Behind. And that's going to give you a different perspective on what we're doing and kind of put into context or contrast, maybe, or illustrate well how vastly different the ways we approach Revelation can be. I've got a copy of The Late Great Planet Earth in my office, if anybody would like to borrow some Hal Lindsey, if it's been so long since you've read Hal, or actually Clarence Larkin, who was the long forerunner before Hal Lindsey. Clarence Larkin was one of the early dispensational writers, made his money because he was the one that first started drawing these little elaborate charts and timelines with pictures and everything that illustrated how things were going to happen. And back in the early 1900s. So you can read any, you know, what we're collectively reading, or you can pick up any book on Revelation and follow along with the biblical text materials. Hopefully what this allows you to do is actually pick up your Bible and go back and read Revelation and do so with a bit more insight and a bit more comfort. More comfort than you previously had. Comfort may not be a good word to use when we read Revelation, but maybe confidence is a better word. So I would encourage you to do that. Read the biblical materials as we go. Read it after we talk about it. Read it multiple times and kind of see if some of the things that we talk about don't settle in or make some more sense maybe than they otherwise did. Revelation chapter 8 is where we'll begin tonight, so I'd invite you to turn there if you have your Bibles. Man, after a year of doing church history and a semester of doing apologetics, I enjoy bringing my Bible down here for Wednesday nights instead of a history book. But that's just me. We saw last week the seventh seal is opened at the beginning. When the angel opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And in this moment, John says, I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Is the seventh seal the seven trumpets? Is it kind of a nesting doll's sort of judgments? The seventh seal opens and it reveals a whole new cycle of seven. Maybe. Or maybe there's a break here between verse 1 and verse 2, and we ended. There's silence in heaven, and that's designed to be a pause before we move into the next cycle. Or is, as we gave a possibility for last week, this silence could be, I'll spit my gum out, it's bothering me. Sorry. My mom would be so embarrassed. It's either not been done or it's been cleaned off. Fausto probably would frown on that. Who do I want to make mad, my mom or Fausto? This half-hour silence could be a preliminary view of eternity or eternal rest. I don't like viewing these things chronologically in Revelation because, you know, we've got here in the seals, we've got the darkening of the skies, the darkening of the sun, and then we're going to come back around here in like the sixth or the fourth trumpet, and then again in the sixth trumpet, we're going to have the darkening of the sun all over again. We have burning up of the grass, and then we're going to have more grass that's going to be, you know, burned up again. And so following them in a strict chronological pattern doesn't seem to fit the nature of the genre of literature. There's something different going on here. But the opening of the seventh seal perhaps could be just a recognition that at some point these warnings begin to intensify. And that is clearly what happens here. The seven angels are given seven trumpets. Another angel who had a golden censer, that's if you have some Orthodox background or Catholic background, the little things that they would swing that have incense in them, perhaps. He has a golden censer. He came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And so whether the incense and the prayers are different or whether the prayers of the saints are the incense being offered, they kind of blend together. In other words, the incense that's offered on the altar before God are the prayers of the saints asking God how much longer, asking God for vengeance, asking God for judgment, asking God for vindication. So there's these little caveats about prayer. Mentions of prayer in Revelation should remind us of the importance of prayer, that they serve a function on the altar before God in the heavenly temple. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and hurled it on the earth. And there came peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. And then the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to sound them. The picture seems to be, and I've given you a quote from a scholar writing on Revelation here, under the first four trumpets, letter A. He says, while the first four seals depicted judgments that are the inevitable consequences of human sinfulness, the trumpets reveal the active involvement of God in bringing punishment upon a wicked world. Now that's his interpretation, his opinion. It happens to be one that I find to be sensible. Four horsemen, even then, the four horsemen ride out from the throne room of God. And so to say that they are not divinely orchestrated may be a bit of a stretch. But again, famine and warfare and violence and death, in a sense those are. They're consequences of human sinfulness. We see the ramifications of those in our world. We could accuse God of instigating all this evil and suffering, but really, we have no one to blame except ourselves. The majority of pain and suffering in our world is there because people disobey God. In our sin, we create all kinds of consequences. But at some point here, we see this angel. We saw in the fifth seal, the saints under the altar crying out to God and praying, how much longer, how much longer, how much longer? And God said, wait, the number is not yet complete. And so now, it seems to be what this angel does, this high priest angel perhaps, gathers fire from the altar that's accumulating these prayers of the saints and hurls it on the earth. And what we're going to see, especially in the first three trumpets, is references towards fire, that we've reached an escalation in God's hand being active in punishing or judging creation. And who knows when this fits chronologically? Is that taking place now? Is this still yet to come? Is it an intensification as we move forward? Kind of let you guys be the judge of that. But Why trumpets? Trumpets is another... why trumpets? We know why seals. John was unveiling what would take place from the ascension of Jesus or from his vision to the future. Why trumpets? Yeah. Trumpets have all kinds of references in the Old Testament. They were used in the temple for what? Sometimes announcing a feast, the holy days. Joshua and the Israelites marching around Jericho. I mean, what else in the ancient world, whether it's Old Testament and Israelite or just the ancient Near East in general? If a king is coming, yeah, or if he's coming out to present something, it may be a feast or festival or just a decree, announce the coming of a king. Sometimes the announcement of a king returning from battle. And sometimes herald something important, but if we're looking for something important other than a king coming or a festival, there's another key important thing it might be, which could be what? Yeah, bad people coming, enemy armies, trouble, danger. You know, it's their tornado siren or, you know, their weather channel letting you know, or these annoying, you know, notices you get on your phone whenever you have a tornado warning. Did y'all get those yesterday? Was it yesterday or day before? They use trumpets to announce the coming of danger, the coming of war. And so I think really the coming of a king and the coming of an enemy are really, they're two sides of the same coin. It depends on who you belong to. If the king is coming, it could be good news or it could be bad news, depending on if he's your king or not. And so trumpet, I really think it's the image of a warning. Or of a notice. And so instead of a seal simply opening up the general process of how things are going to play out, the trumpets communicate to us that at some point, and maybe from the beginning, maybe from the beginning of John's vision, there are trumpets scattered along the way. They may not be as frequent. Or maybe this is something that happens at a particular moment in time where these plagues escalate. And their purpose is not just the consequences of human sinfulness. Their purpose is God is sending a notice that people are running out of time. He's sending a warning. And as we read through the trumpets, I think you'll see that that's exactly what these portend. Yes? I don't think it's literal trumpets, perhaps, so much as the things that are happening serve the role of a trumpet. Yeah. That these kinds of disasters, plagues, that's the other thing about the trumpets. And a lot of times, man, we read and we interpret them on their own. It may not even, you know, you're going to see in some of these, I've given you a different position and what they claim this to be, the trumpets to be. Look at what I've given you here on B. The trumpet plagues all harken back to the plagues of the Exodus. Okay? This is where you have to know the Old Testament to really read Revelation. And it may be that these are supposed to be literal transactions, or it may be that there are similar transactions to what we had taking place in Exodus. And the purpose of the plagues in Exodus, think back to all the theological ramifications of what was going on when the Nile turns to blood and the frogs come up on land and all the fish start dying and the cattle start getting sick and insects start breeding. All the theological ramifications, you had Pharaoh who had his own gods, himself as a god, and those plagues were designed to illustrate God's power over the other quote-unquote gods. You had the people of God, in some cases who were faithful, in some cases who had forgotten God. And it's designed to the plagues were designed to remind them of who the true God really was and what he was really capable of. And all of those plagues were there kind of lining the way, paving the way for the people of God to exodus out from slavery and begin journeying towards the promised land. And so if you think about that picture in the context of this final cosmic drama that's being played out, these trumpets are serve the same function, whether they're literal trumpets, whether they're literal calamities, or whether they're representative of all manner of calamities. These things serve the purpose of communicating the power of God and giving the Pharaohs and the Egyptians and the backward sliding Israelites an opportunity to be reminded who the true God is, how powerful he is, what he is capable of, and a chance to turn back to him before the 10th plague comes, right? Before death comes, and before the people of God begin wandering away from this home towards their promised home. Exodus is local, historical, concrete. Revelation is spiritual, universal. But the parallels are pretty strong, I would suggest. And so as we read through these trumpets, think about what you know of the plagues from the book of Exodus. The first four bring judgment on nature or on creation itself. By the way, that's the 10 plagues in Egypt. The first several were on nature before they started afflicting humanity. The last three bring judgment on people. The significance of trumpets, which we've already talked about. So, the first trumpet, verse 7. The first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down upon the earth. A third of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. Hail and fire mixed with blood. Exodus chapter 9, verse 13 and following. Let's see if I can mark my place here. If you guys want to read along, you can. If you just want to hold your spot and let me read to you, I'm happy to do that as well. Verse 9:13, the plague of hail, the seventh plague. The Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh, say to him, this is what the Lord says. So you may know, verse 16, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. Verse 20, those officials of Pharaoh who feared the word of the Lord hurried to bring their slaves and livestock inside. But those who ignored the word of the Lord left their slaves and livestock in the field. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky so that hail will fall all over Egypt on men and animals and everything growing in the fields of Egypt. Moses stretched out his staff, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and lightning flashed down to the ground. So the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. Hail fell, lightning flashed back and forth. It was the worst storm in all the land of Egypt since it had become a nation. Throughout Egypt, hail struck everything in the fields, both men and animals. It beat down everything growing in the fields and stripped every tree. The only place it did not hail was the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were. Trumpet number one seems to hearken back to plague number seven, an incredibly violent hailstorm with lightning and thunder. The blood, more likely referring to the red color of lightning striking the ground and trees being uprooted whenever that happens. That part of creation, it's affecting the earth, the trees, and the grass. A third of the earth, a third of the trees burned up. And so I told you last week, or in case you missed it, or in case you need a reminder, really only in one or two of the seals did it reference a number that a fourth of the population was affected, either in nature or people. And so we've moved from a fourth to a third. It's an intensification. When we get to the third cycle of seven, the seven bowls of wrath, which again, we move from trumpets, which are warnings, to bowls of wrath, the wrath of God being poured out, those afflict all. We go fourth to a third to 100%. That's the movement of these cycles. So, trumpet number one. You see in the notes there, some have tried to literally nail down a single event or what this might have been. For the historicists that want to find all of this, or the preterists locating this in the original context, this is a war between Rome and the Goths and Vandals, those that eventually would subdue the Roman Empire. The futurists, Hal Lindsey notoriously said this was a nuclear war or a nuclear bomb. Could be. Sounds like it. Clearly it points back to Exodus, to a hailstorm. Does that, and so this goes back to the question earlier, does that mean it's a literal hailstorm? Does it mean it's a singular hailstorm? Does it mean that in storms or hailstorms like this or whatever else, that at some point you're going to see an escalation in these natural disasters or natural tragedies that are God-created more so than they are human sinfulness created? And if that's the case, do they serve the purpose of turning people back to God? And if you know where this is going, you're going to know some people will turn back to God, but the majority of people will dig their heels in and become even more obstinate than they were before. Thoughts or questions about the first trumpet? Comments? Second trumpet. Second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. A third, again, of the sea turned into blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died. And a third of the ships were destroyed. Notice, however it's describing it, a third of the ships destroyed, it doesn't mention humanity specifically. A third of the sea, a third of the fish, a third of the ships, an inanimate object. Does that affect people? Surely it does. But as it's communicated, the plague does not pour out on humanity specifically yet. It's still creation. All right? Exodus chapter 7, verse 20 and 21. First plague. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded. He raised his staff in the presence of Pharaoh and his officials and struck the water of the Nile, and all the water was changed into blood. The fish in the Nile died, and the river smelled so bad that the Egyptians could not drink its water. Blood was everywhere in Egypt. The futurists see a large object from the sky, perhaps a meteor, perhaps some kind of, maybe this is maybe an after effect of a nuclear bomb or a nuclear war from the first trumpet. Historicists say this is a strong nation. It's kind of vague. The historicists, once they've already played their Goths and Vandals card from the first trumpet, they're out of, who's left? The Parthians. But we've got to save them for the locust plague that's coming later because they have long hair. So we got to save the Parthians for later. So we just kind of have a generic strong nation somewhere in the middle. Many would see here an example of the volcanic activity of the Greek Mediterranean world. I remember being a kid and thinking, what does that mean, a mountain falls into the sea? And then the first time I heard somebody say, well, that's volcanic activity, I thought, well, duh, that makes sense. That's, you know, I don't know that that's it, but it was a lot more sensible to me than, you know, than a meteor falling into the oceans. Again, if we're trying to find a single moment, a single activity, that's a little bit harder to do. But if it's exclusively a future activity, then it's something we haven't even seen yet, something we have no idea what it is. But we move from hailstorms to volcanoes here. Still seems to be natural, the kinds of things we would call natural disasters. The things your insurance company would call what? Act of God. Yeah, we're not covering, we'll define our coverage based on whether it's an act of God or not. Actually, the airline companies do that too. If it's a mechanical failure, then we'll give you a place to stay. If it's an act of God, it's not our fault. You're on your own, getting your own hotel if your layover extends overnight. So, second trumpet, again, it's a little bit vague, and I think it's intentionally so. I think it's intended to be vague. I think it's open to a number of interpretations, but again, clearly pointing back to the Exodus, clearly pointing back to the plagues of Egypt. And at some point, these things are supposed to give people's attention towards God. You know, this happened when Hurricane Katrina hit. It happened when, what else? There have been two or three natural disasters in the last decade. Maybe when the last hurricane that hit this area. What was that? Rita? Ike. Thanks. And you've had, you know, kind of your Pat Robertsons or your TBN guys or your Jerry Falwells, and I shouldn't name names. Some of the talking heads within the Christian community that would come out and say, well, that's God's judgment on all of those sinful people in New Orleans, or that's God's judgment on all those, you know, sinful people in New York that God allowed the World Trade Centers to get hit. Very different. It's a different thing when we talk about sinful humanity causing something to happen versus a hurricane coming in or a tsunami hitting Japan or Korea or earthquakes or hurricanes in Haiti and places like that. Every time something really terrible happens, you've got, you know, a Christian group or organization or figure that wants to say, well, that's God's judgment on the people that live in that particular place. And on the one hand, that's incredibly insensitive. And to imply that that's God's, you know, that Hurricane Katrina was God's judgment on all the sinners in New Orleans implies that there are no sinners here in Houston and that's why it didn't hit here. Or that there were no sinners in Miami and that's the reason why I went to New Orleans and didn't go somewhere else, or whatever the case may be. I think it's poor taste, poor communication, poor example for us as Christians. That being said, natural disasters as a whole, in general, they strike all over the place. And it doesn't matter if you live in Oklahoma and you're worried about tornadoes, or if you live in the far north and you're worried about blizzards, and or if you're living in Northern California right now and you're worried about the dam breaking, you're worried about flooding or forest fires, or whether you live down here and you're worried about almost anywhere you go, drought, anywhere in the world you go, there's some kind of natural calamity to be worried about or to watch. And those kinds of things, Revelation would suggest that they're designed to remind us of God's power and the brokenness of creation, and that God is the one we need to place our trust in, not anything based here in this world. And so, might we expect, there are those who would say we've had an intensification of a lot of these natural disasters over the last 50 years. I don't know if that's indeed the case or if our ability to identify them and recognize them and hear about them from around the world has increased, or if they really have increased. But at some point, these are trumpets. These are God's acts of judgment that seem to be escalating as we move closer towards the end. And still holding back. Very good point, Ricky. Still holding back. It's only a third affected by these things. And that's not literally a third, but it's a minority. It's a minority. I mean, a third is less than half, right? It's affecting a large number of people, but it's not affecting most of us. And so a hurricane hits New Orleans. It affects all of us. Our insurance premiums might go up, but, you know, a hurricane or earthquakes in Haiti, and we all send $5 through American Red Cross on our phones, or send money. We send ministry teams over there to work. But it's still a minority. God is holding back. But then we have to wrestle with the problem of evil and suffering if it's God's hand causing these things to happen. Anyways, let's keep going. A third angel, verse 10, sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter. People are affected, but the plague is poured out on the waters. Here, instead of the oceans, the seafaring places, it's our source of drinking. Springs, rivers, fresh water has a direct effect on humanity. Wormwood goes back to by the way, I put a list here back to that first plague in Exodus as well, that the rivers were so affected that people couldn't even drink them. The same plague that we just read a while ago. But also, gave you a reference to wormwood. There's several in the Old Testament. I chose this one in Jeremiah because I think it's the closest to what wormwood is referencing here. Chapter 9, verse 15. Therefore, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. See, I will make this people eat bitter food and drink poisoned water. Poison water, it's the word from where wormwood comes from. Bitter, actually the word is bitter. What do you have in Hebrew, Ricky? Do you have your Hebrew Bible there? Jeremiah 9:15. I should have looked that up. Mara. Yeah. Yeah. The plant. The plant is what it's referring to in Revelation. Wormwood is a plant that would make it very bitter. Mara is, you guys will know Mara from the book of Ruth. Whenever Naomi comes home and everybody says, ah, Naomi's come home, and her name means joy, she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. Don't call me joyful, call me bitter. Because I've lost, you know, my husband and lost my sons, and I'm not joyful at all. I'm a bitter old woman. Referring to the food or the water? To the plant, yeah. Wormwood, that's the plant. And so it implies bitterness. It would poison the water. How about this star that falls? Man, what do I have on here? Some say this is the Antichrist or that this is Satan, the star falling. I think it's a bit of a stretch at this point. I saw one writer, he said it would be very awkward for John to introduce Satan at this point in such a vague, nondescript point. Satan's going to make an entrance, and it's going to be a grand, if you will, or a awful or terrible entrance momentarily once we get a few more chapters in. Antichrist is not the same as Satan. Antichrist, in the dispensational view, is Satan's, well, the Antichrist is Jesus. He is what Jesus is to God, the Antichrist is to Satan. But there's all kinds of theological conundrums there. I really prefer John's point in his letter in 1 John, where he says to the early church, you keep looking for an Antichrist, and I tell you that there are many. That there are many antichrists, and you're waiting for the antichrist to come, but I tell you there are many antichrists that have already come. And so it'd be best for us not to put in antichrist here whenever we haven't really been introduced to the antichrist in the book of Revelation yet. We're preempting the description of somebody in retrospect, and I think that may be careless to do as well. Still leaves the question of what is this star that falls from the sky. Again, here we may have, I mean, take your pick, acid rain, a lack of rain, famine. What kinds of things could happen that would affect, drinking water, rivers and springs? Who knows? Is it natural disaster again? Is it following the trend of the first two trumpets? To me, I would think that it is, the same way that the four horsemen follow in succession. A good comment was made a week ago about that the four horsemen, kind of one led to another, led to another, led to another. I don't know if we have the same here, because these are a little bit tougher to identify. The first four, the four horsemen are pretty easy. Warfare, famine, violence, death and disease. Here, really, it's the natural order is affected in such a way. The things that humanity rely on, the grass, the plants, the trees, the oceans, our fresh water. And then in the case of the fourth trumpet, the fourth angel sounded his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck. You know, here we go back to, so now if we're really working at literal translations here, literal interpretations, how do we do that? A third of the sun, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of them turned dark. A third of the day was without light. and also a third of the night. What? What's going on? How do we render that literally? A third of the sun. Is this like a pie chart and we cut out a third of it? A third of the day is without light. Well, we are really, a third of the day is already without light. A third of the night. The stars are going to be out for a third of the night, but not the whole night. We almost have to think poetically here, and we have to think theologically here. This is the ninth plague, I believe, is it not? Exodus 10, verse 21. You'll also see there on the notes, darkness is used in the Old Testament often as a symbolic picture of judgment or of evil. 10, verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky so that darkness will spread over Egypt, darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or leave his place for 3 days. Any of you guys remember in some of the local historical ways of interpreting this in Egypt, that the sun was blacked out and nobody could see anything for 3 days sometimes is thought to be what natural phenomenon? Yeah, a sandstorm, yeah, or what they would call a Khamsin in Egypt, just these dust storms. There have been a couple of Hollywood movies that were made. When I talked about this in a sermon, I couldn't remember the name of the movie, and then my dad got onto me because he listened to the sermon, and it's one of his favorite movies. He's like, how could you not remember that? It's where they're racing through the desert, and a guy, like a cowboy on his horse, is racing all these Middle Eastern people, and I still can't remember the name of it, so please don't tell my dad if you see him. Hidalgo, that's the one. But they talk about the sandstorms, and I mean, they're incredibly fearful. We don't get it because we don't have them here. They do have them in Arizona, where it totally blacks out the sun and where you can't see anything. Well, I'll take your word for it then. I've not experienced one. I'll take your word for it. That in Exodus, that's what it's referring to. In Revelation, it doesn't specify anything about that unless it's just counting on us to connect the dots between Exodus and Revelation. The blacking out of the sun. It may not be referring to a specific sandstorm, but again, even in Exodus, this is a natural disaster kind of phenomenon. Siri could tell us the movie was Hidalgo. That's what I should have done, is asked her. So, a third of the sun, a third of the moon. I mean, we move into the modern day, and people could say, well, maybe it's not, you know, maybe it's smog, maybe it's, you know, pollution, maybe it's, maybe it is a sandstorm in only certain parts of the world where they have sand, or maybe it's, but again, it only affects a third of this, a third of that, a third of something else. For us as concrete Western thinkers, we have a hard time reading these trumpets and not immediately defaulting to, what does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? What is a one-for-one equality here? We have a hard time doing that. We have a hard time not doing that. If you draw back a little bit and you think a little bit more poetically, a little bit more holistically, at the big picture, instead of trying to make one for one, try to make the picture as a whole of Exodus and the plagues and what they were designed to do carry forward into a season in which God begins to escalate some of these natural disasters at a point where his power is made manifest. Those that have eyes to see will see it and recognize it. Those that do not will hide themselves in the caves and the rocks. They're warnings. They're designed to draw people's attention towards God, towards his impending return. And some will see it and recognize it, and some will not. Within that context, who knows if in the future there won't be some giant asteroid and its name is Wormwood and it comes crashing through and lands on the Mississippi River and none of us have fresh water if you live in the Mississippi River region. I don't know. That's kind of poking fun at it, but not entirely. I mean, how this plays out in the future, we don't really know. But as often as you see these calamitous natural disasters, I hope you will, with sensitivity, and even in conversation, when people say, how horrible is that would happen? How could God let that happen? You say, you know what? these things have happened forever. And whenever we see these acts of God in nature, they should really cause all of us to rethink our belief about God and what we believe about God and how we respond to God. Do we see these things, the power of nature at work? Do we see them and then just say, eh, and go on about our lives? Do we ignore them because it affected a third of humanity and we were not part of the third affected, so we just don't worry about it and move on? Or do we allow those things to cause us to hear the trumpet, figuratively speaking, to hear the warning that the end may be coming after our lifetimes, but if Jesus doesn't come back before we die, we're going to go meet him, and we're going to join the souls under the altar crying out for God's return, and we're going to be present whenever it begins, whether we're present there or present here. So, do we give heed to the sound of the trumpets? First four trumpets. Let's finish chapter 8, and then we'll pause for a moment. After these four, we have a little omen. It says, "As I watched, I heard an eagle that was flying in midair call out in a loud voice, 'Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the trumpet blasts about to be sounded by the other three angels.'" We don't really have a cutesy little name for the first four trumpets like we do for the four horsemen of the seals. But the last three trumpets are sometimes referred to as the three woes. The eagle speaks about them. The woes are coming because these will not just affect creation, they will affect us, mankind. Why an eagle? Perhaps speaking to a lot of these apocalyptic and judgmental images of the birds gathering for the great feast of the day of God's judgment. So you have this predatory bird circling and speaking about the woes that are going to come. So that's trumpets 1, 2, 3, 4. Any questions or thoughts about those? Comments? Anything you've heard that you thought made sense? Anything you've heard about them that just sounded ludicrous to you? Really? Nobody? All right. I explained it perfectly then. Yeah. Chapter 9. You'll notice the trumpets, the descriptions of them get longer as we move into these woes. "The fifth angel sounded his trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. When he opened the abyss, smoke rose from it, like the smoke from a gigantic furnace. The sun and sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss, and out of the smoke, locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass." There's still grass, even though it seems like it was all burned up in trumpet one. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were not given power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. And the agony they suffered was like that of the sting of a scorpion when it strikes a man. During those days, men will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. And then it gives a description. "The locusts looked like horses prepared for battle. On their heads, they wore something like crowns of gold, and their faces resembled human faces. Their hair was like women's hair, and their teeth were like lions' teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. They had tails and stings like scorpions, and in their tails they had the power to torment people for 5 months. They had as king over them the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek apollyon. The first woe is past, two other woes are yet to come. Everything in Revelation seems to be neat and tidy to me up until this point. And it's at this point that things start really getting weird. Okay? That's just me. Maybe they got weird for you a long time ago. Or maybe you have images of, you know, old 80s made-for-Christian movies and you got locust monsters coming and stinging people. Or we've heard in some more modern ages that these are helicopters that, you know, are pouring poison gas out of their, you know, fuselages or whatever. Who knows? Big picture, here's what we see. And by the way, a star falls, it's given a key to the abyss, unlocks the abyss. Later on in Revelation, we're going to have an angel come and open, has a key and opens the pit that Satan will be thrown into. And so there's a lot of theories. You see here the star. Some have said it's Satan. Some have said it's the angel, a fallen angel. I tend to prefer number four, the fourth option I've given you here, a divine agent carrying out God's will, that this is an angel or an emissary of God in some capacity that's coming to unleash a new level of judgment or a new level of warning on people. So I'm fairly comfortable with that interpretation, but that's, again, that's me. The abyss. What is that? What is the abyss? There's really nothing in this first woe that necessitates we start thinking demonic here, except for that. Coming from the abyss. It's not coming from the throne, in other words. It's not coming from the place where God dwells. This angel has come down to earth and is opening up something and releasing something that does not come from the heavens, does not come from God. And so it's either earthly or we have finally breached the realm of the spiritually demonic here in the fifth trumpet. And that is quite possible. Yeah. Locusts. Locusts, again, it's a plague from Egypt. I've given you the reference here, Exodus 10. It's the eighth plague, the plague of locusts. Also, the prophetic book of Joel, all of the first chapter of Joel refers to as locust plague. Locusts would come in, and much like the dust storm, well, apparently the dust storm is more indigenous here than I knew. I don't know that we have locust plagues here in North America, but in the Middle East, locust plagues would come through and they would literally eat everything. Everything. For miles and miles wide and traveling 40, 50, 60 miles long. They would eat anything that was green. And the lifespan of a locust, anybody want to take a guess? Yeah, 5 months. Why the significance of 5 months? So lifespan of a locust. I don't know that there's any significance there. Other than that, it's a lot of these judgments, you're going to see this again here in the next trumpet, God holds back what Ricky mentioned earlier. God is constraining them to a certain appointed window of time, and it's brief, but during that window of time, you see here, the suffering is intense. Yeah. Oh, we have them. What's that? Yeah. Is this a regular happening or was this a one-time deal? Interesting. I didn't know that. For the recording, this conversation is about a story in the mythos of the Mormon church about a locust plague in Utah, I presume, in which the seagulls came and ate the locusts, and so the seagull has a place of prominence in some of their iconography. Is that fair to summarize? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Could be. Yeah, the darkening of the sun with locusts. Yeah. It could, I mean, you see, if you follow the notes here, see, locusts usually devour crops, but here they're not given power to harm crops. They can only harm people. And so that's certainly different than just regular locusts. Treatment for 5 months is the lifespan. Here's three options. Are these locusts figurative of armies, military activity, warfare again? Is it demonic forces, number two, or is this just a locust plague? Yeah. So, again, I can only tell you what things that I've read that I've found to be convincing. But when it goes, as long as it's just talking about locusts, that they have the power of a scorpion, doesn't mean they look like a scorpion, but that these locusts can sting, and that when they do, it hurts really bad. I mean, at that point, these are just locusts that maybe it's a different kind of bug. I mean, it's not the horsefly version of the locust. But when it gets to the description in verse 7, and it says they look like horses prepared for battle. See, again, it seems to be talking about size. When it talks about that their heads had crowns and their faces resembled human faces, that something, that looking into them, it didn't look just like the simple animal world, but looked like something a little bit more intelligent, a little bit more sentient. That they have long hair, that they have fierce teeth. Again, I don't know that it's designed to be giving us physical description any more than when it says Jesus is covered with eyes from head to foot, or that the beasts were covered with eyes, that that's a physical description. These things are supposed to talk about maybe, the face is, it's still a locust, but that they are operating with a kind of intelligence and wisdom because they're on a mission from God, that the long hair sometimes is thought to refer to speed with which they move, that the ferocity of their teeth, that they're vicious, that they bite. Again, armies, I don't like that particular interpretation. I could go either way with demonic forces, or that these are some kind of different that these are locusts, and they're big, and they are appointed by God, and that they are causing plagues on humanity. That they come out of the abyss is a different nuance. We haven't had that before. And so this seems to be something transpiring that I don't think we've seen before in our lifetimes or in the history of the church. This is where, by the way, the historians would say, these are the Parthians. The Parthians were known for having long hair. And they rode horses, and so we seize on the horses and the long hair, and that they were enemies of Rome, and that's why they would lean towards this being an army reference, perhaps. And that's not entirely unreasonable, but that gives it a localized interpretation way back in the past, in the historical past, with no relevance moving forward throughout the history of the church or into the future. So, look, like I said, I feel very comfortable with my interpretation of everything in Revelation up to this point. Here, the waters start to get very muddy to me. But this is only the first place. It will not be the last. So any of the questions or comments or thoughts here? I think the importance is to notice that the eagle has portended these woes. Whatever this is, it's designed to be painfully afflicting towards humanity. A third of humanity again? I didn't remember seeing it. Either way, it's a painful, tormenting, limited woe on humanity. And the purpose is for it to get people to repent, to return to God. It's judgment, but it's not judgment that ends in death yet. It's temporary. It's suffering in this life. Yeah. Yeah. We can say those things for sure, and maybe that's as much as we need to say. That the things that we suffer in this life, no matter how acute they might be, our temporary sufferings and our pain, if it's not natural disasters, if it's cancer, if it's disease, if it's loss, those kinds of pains we feel individually, if we really want to spiritualize this, probably more broadly than we should, but that even those things are temporary, but they're designed to turn us back to God, to draw us to God. The fifth woe was pain and suffering. The sixth one is going to bring death specifically into the picture. So let's go there. I gave you a reference to Abaddon and Job. It's worth looking up, but we're short on time. The sixth angel sounded his trumpet, and I heard a voice coming from the horns of the golden altar that is before God. It said to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, "Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." And the four angels who had been kept ready for this very hour and day and month and year. That it may not have been on anybody else's day planner, but it's been on God's, going all the way back to the time John wrote. God had it planned. The very hour, day, and month were released to kill a third of mankind. The number of the mounted troops, and in the NIV it says 200 million. I heard their number. I think in Greek it says a double myriad of myriads. And so Greek makes it sound a little bit more symbolic, perhaps, than the English translation that counts it exactly. Although John says, "I heard their number." And so he may be seeking to refer to a very literal number here. "The horses and riders I saw in my vision," again, we get very kind of demonic type imagery here. "Their breastplates were fiery red, dark blue and yellow as sulfur. The heads of the horses resembled the heads of lions. Out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and sulfur. A third of mankind was killed by the three plagues of fire, smoke, and sulfur that came out of their mouths." Notice, the horses have riders, but the problem is the horses, not the riders. It's kind of switched from what you would expect with an army. The horses carry the riders that are the problem here, the horses. "Out of their mouth comes these plagues that kill a third of mankind. The power of the horses was in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails were like snakes, having heads with which they inflict injury. The rest of mankind that were not killed by these plagues still did not repent of the work of their hands. They did not stop worshiping demons and idols of gold, silver, bronze, stone, and wood, idols that cannot see or hear or walk, nor did they repent of their murders, their magic arts, their sexual immorality, or their thefts." It closes again, reminding us that even death, the death of people around us, whether they die in wars, whether they die from disease, whether they die from old age, that death in and of itself grieves people and should cause us to turn to God. This may be some future increase, some cataclysmic increase. Maybe it's demonic forces. Who knows? But the first and second woes have affected humanity with suffering and with death, but both designed to cause people to turn back to God. And you saw in the description there that many, many people in those moments do not. They dig their heels in and they shake their fist at heaven and they say, "We're going to keep living our lives how we want. We don't care how much God warns us, how much God punishes us. We're going to live our lives how we want to live." And so again, the trumpets serve the purpose of warning. Here at the end of trumpet number six, we have a pause before we get to trumpet number seven. And just like in the seven seals, the pause is going to draw attention to the people of God. There it were the saints under the altar. It were the 144,000 on earth that were sealed. The next two, there's going to be two images in this interlude, and it's going to talk about the people of God. Witnesses, the church, Israel. And so this is where we begin kind of wrestling with, what do the people of God look like as this is taking place? Do we have the church and Israel separate? Are the church and Israel one? Is the church raptured and Israel left? But instead of talking about humanity under warnings and plagues and judgments, now we kind of pull back and look at the people of God. And so that's where we'll be next week, the next two chapters, at these two visions. And don't lose track, because the interlude is longer. Don't lose track that we're here in between trumpet six and trumpet 7. And we won't get to trumpet 7 for, well, that's chapter 9, 10, 11, to chapter 12, for our purposes, several weeks away. But don't lose track of that, okay?